discuss the chiral anomaly in massless two-dimensional QED. A topic you've looked at a little bit in your first homework. It's a very nice example for understanding the physics of the anomaly. And so we'll just go through this in some more detail than what you saw in the homework. What we're going to do today is first we'll study the classical two-dimensional massless quantum electrodynamics, and then we will treat the theory in the simplest possible way. We'll treat the we'll quantize the fermions, treat the photon as classical. Not the most general thing we can do, but it simplifies the treatment and allows us to derive the anomaly in the simplest possible way so we can get some physical picture for what's going on. And we'll, later this week, we will study the chiral anomaly from the functional integral perspective and relax some of the assumptions we'll make today. So some of the assumptions we may make may seem a little bit restrictive. They can be dropped at the cost of complicating the derivation and the discussion. So for the most part, the assumptions and approximations we're going to make are just for simplicity of exposition. So the theory we're going to study is one that's familiar to you. So in QFT1, we studied QED and massless QED in four dimensions. So not very much is different if we go to two dimensions. So the to start off with, we can look at just a massless free fermion in four dimensions. This is a theory Gong told you a lot about in QFT1. And in particular, I'd just like to remind you that this theory has two symmetries, two U1 symmetries. So it has a U1 symmetry under which the fermion field picks up a phase. So this is a U1 symmetry, and I'll call it the U1 vector symmetry. Here, B is for vector. And that notation comes from the fact that the conserved current associated with this symmetry be denoted either J mu V or just J mu transforms like a vector under Lorentz transformations. So this is the vector current, and it's conserved by Noether's theorem. So this symmetry would persist even if we added a mass term. But what's special about the massless theory is that it has an additional U1 symmetry, which is the called the U1 axial symmetry, under which the fermion field transforms like e to the I alpha gamma 5 times psi. And the conserved current in this case transforms like an axial vector under Lorentz transformations. And this I'll either call it the axial current, or I'll write J mu 5. So 5 just refers to the gamma 5, which is in both the transformation law and the conserved current. So both of these symmetries are symmetries of this theory in four dimensions, and they have these conserved currents. And so massless QED has precisely the same symmetries. What would change if we were going to massless QED is we'd just replace this partial derivative with the covariant derivative. And if so in massless QED, we have the same symmetries end currents, where the gauge field transforms trivially. So the presence of the gauge field doesn't change either these currents or these cylinders. So this is a story, a familiar story from four dimensions from QFT1. So the only thing we're going to change now is we're going to go to two dimensions. And in 2D, almost nothing changes. In fact, all of the equations I've written on the board are still valid. The only thing we have to change is that gamma matrices will take a different form. So in 2D, the gamma matrices should satisfy the anti-commutation relation. The anti-commutator of gamma mu with gamma nu is 2 eta mu nu. And for today's lecture, I'm going to be working on the Lorentzian signature with a metric of 1 and minus 1.
Question?
Yes.
Shouldn't it be a gauge transformation for AMU? Why AMU goes to AMU?
Yes, in QED, we also have, compared to just the free fermion, we'll have a gauge symmetry. So that's an extra symmetry. But these two global symmetries persist. I'm not making it this, well, I'm specifically referring to the global subgroup of the gauge U1 symmetry, under which,
If we weak rotate, do the commutation relations change, or do they still stay the same?
So these, this equation defines the commutation relations between the gamma matrices. So what would change is that eta would instead be +1, +1.
Okay, so the eta would change if
eta would change, but this equation would not change. Next, on Thursday, we'll be mostly working in Euclidean, and I'll say a few more things about what changes. Also, the hermeticity properties will change when we go to Euclidean as a consequence of this. Okay, so that's the main change, and it'll be convenient to work in the chiral basis. For most of today's lecture. So chiral basis, you can choose gamma 0 to be the first polymatrix, and gamma 1 to be I times the second polymatrix, gamma 5 to be minus gamma 0, gamma 1, which is the third polymatrix. So all these matrices are just ones and zeros. Makes some of the calculations much easier. Yes.
I'm still stuck in that. I'm sorry. If you take the global subgroup, then you're saying that the AMU doesn't change. But how do you have a coupling with the fermion, the gauge field?
So in QED, what we would change is we change this partial derivative to covariant derivative, and we'd add the kinetic term for the gauge field. So that has a gauge symmetry. If we change amu to amu plus d mu alpha, that's the symmetry of the theory. It's a symmetry of the theory where alpha is constant, and then that's still a symmetry. So we can choose alpha to be any function we like, including a constant.
Which is not a function of space-time.
Not a function of space-time, so then the derivative of alpha will vanish, and so then that's this subgroup. So I'm allowed to choose alpha to be constant.
Mm-hmm.
considering that term for now. We'll come back to that later. So, in two dimensions, just like in four dimensions, we can break up a Dirac spinner into two parts. So, gamma five, react with gamma five on projection of psi, projection operators acting on psi, and we'll get back plus or minus p plus or minus times psi. So we can break up a Dirac spinner into positive and negative chirality components. So these are, we can call, call p plus psi to be psi plus, and that's the positive chirality component. And so here p plus and minus are just the same as they would be in four dimensions, just one plus or minus gamma 5 over 2.
Sorry, is that gamma 5 in the first line?
Gamma 5, yes. And these are sometimes called p right or left. Yes. So
in the gamma matrices of 4x4, you have like a two-dimensional subspace for each chirality, and that's like a particle and an antiparticle?
That's right.
So what does it mean here that it's now only one-dimensional? Are there no antiparticles, or are they like just completely separate, or?
So what we're going to see is that so there still will be particles and antiparticles of each chirality. The different chiralities will correspond to particles moving in different directions. So I'll get that in a minute, but in two dimensions, unlike in four dimensions, these different chirality components tell us about whether the particles are moving to the left or the right. But yeah, there's just one degree of freedom in each chirality component. Okay. So if we look at the fermion kinetic term, now including the coupling to the photon, we can break it up into positive and negative chirality pieces. If we do that, what we'll be left with, this is a dagger, is the following expression. So get one term that depends just on the positive chirality part, has coupling to different components of the gauge field. And we'll have a second term that also, only depends on the negative chirality component of the fermion. So what's important about this expression is that there's no mixing. And there's another way we can state this. So this is tells us that we can construct we could take linear combinations of our two symmetries over here, the vector and axial currents, and write them write symmetries that correspond to conservation of positive chirality, the number of positive chirality particles and the number of negative chirality particles. So there's no mixing between the two. So number of particles in each sector should be separately conserved. And so that conservation law would just look something like this. This is separate conservation of number currents. And the plus and minus vectors. And this conservation equation is, of course, just a linear combination of the conservation equations for these two currents. So, the next thing I'm going to do is to solve the equations of motion for the fermion field. The free theory. So I'm going to just temporarily set the gauge field to zero. And in this case, the equation of motion becomes just I d0 plus or minus I d1 I plus or minus zero. You could see that just by replacing. So if A is 0, these big D's are the same as partials. And if we vary just with respect to the conjugate side of our dagger, we'll get these equations. And so this is an equation we can more or less solve by inspection. So the solution to this equation, it's just a wave moving to the left or the right at the speed of light. And the left moving waves correspond to the negative chirality, and right moving waves correspond to the positive chirality. So the next thing. So this is basically all I can say about the free fermion theory. So the next thing we want to do is see what happens when we include a gauge field. And for simplicity, we're going to try to gauge fix as much as possible. We'll just do our calculation in a particular gauge that we'll try to make things as simple as possible. And there's one complication we need to address first if we want to turn on a gauge field. So, and that's the fact that in two dimensions, the Coulomb potential grows linearly with distance. So if we have a point charge, it will create an electric field. In four dimensions, the electric field will decrease with distance due to Coulomb's law. But in two dimensions, two dimensions being one space and one time dimension, a point charge just creates a constant electric field. So it creates a linearly growing Coulomb potential, which is problematic if we want to consider a quantum theory, treating the coupling of the gauge field with the fermion as some perturbative parameter. Because in two dimensions, for sufficiently large distances, any two particles, regardless of how small their charge is, will become strongly coupled. So if we want to avoid strong coupling and be able to treat our system perturbatively, we need to prevent two fermions from being able to be too far away. And the simplest way to do that is just put our theory on some compactified space, like a circle. So what we're going to do is we're going to compactify on a circle with periodicity L such that our charge times L is much less than 1. So we can use perturbation theory. And this is another reason that, well, I'm not going to go in that direction today, but it's another reason this model is interesting. This 2D massless QED, also known as the Schwinger model. So this is kind of a toy model for confinement. This is a much simpler theory than QCD in 4 dimensions, but it also confines. Okay, so if we want to use perturbation theory, we should consider this theory on a circle. And as I mentioned before, we're going to try to gauge fix as much as possible in order to simplify our discussion. So in general,
So does then the Coulomb potential still, what is the form? Once we compact,
it'll still grow linearly, but if we have two, we're just choosing the parameters of our theory such that if we have two fermions that are on opposite sides of our space, that the potential is still some small interaction. They don't interact. Very much.
Yes. How do we exactly impose boundary conditions on a circle if we have a linearly growing solution? How do we match points at, let's say, 0 and 2 pi?
So what we're going to demand is that our fields obey the boundary conditions. So they're the same. They obey periodic boundary conditions. And we're going to... So in particular, we'll demand that our fields A mu and psi are periodic or anti-periodic. So
then it's not linear, really, right?
So the statement is that the Coulomb potential is linear. So if we calculate it, the Coulomb potential is like some a classical thing we could calculate by looking at certain amplitudes in the quantum field theory and in taking various limits.
So this is just like some classical argument.
That's right. I'm not making this very precise, and it's there are a number of things I'm doing mainly to simplify the argument that can be made more precise, and we'll do some of that on Thursday, but. Today, I just want to try to motivate things, and I'm not going to dot all the I's and cross all the T's. So if we have a theory on a circle, then our gauge field, we can write it in terms of its Fourier components. Take some form like this. Okay. So if A is this form, A is periodic with period L. Should be an N. Something over N. And so this is general. We're going to pick a gauge that will make our treatment of the quantum theory, again, we're only going to treat part of the system quantum mechanically, as simple as possible. And so let's see what what gauge freedom do we have that can make a slightly simpler form. So under gauge transformation, A transforms to itself plus the derivative of some function alpha. And if we want to eliminate some of the terms in that Fourier expansion of A, a good choice, we can choose alpha to be minus the sum of L over 2 pi n A1 of t sine 2 pi n over L x. So with this choice, which makes sense as long as n is not 0, we can eliminate the spatial dependence of A1. So we can take A1 of x and t going to A1 of t. Okay, and we will, that simplifies at least this one component of the gauge field. So the first spatial component just has to be some time-varying constant. But we can do better than this. A is a physical field. It should be periodic, but there's no reason that this alpha needs to be periodic. And so we could choose alpha to be 2 pi nx over L. So this respects the periodicity of A, even though this is not a periodic function. And by taking this form of the gauge field and doing a further gauge transformation with the gauge parameter alpha equal to 2 pi x over L and x over L, we see that so this derivative will just give us a 2 pi n x over L. And we see that A1 and A1 plus 2 pi n over L are gauge equivalent. For integer n. And so we should think of this spatial component of our gauge field as living on a circle as well. So this tells us that A1 lives on a circle of circumference 2 pi over L. And well, this is the best we can do. The integral of the gauge field around a loop is gauge invariant. It's a Wilson loop. It can't be changed by gauge transformation. So there's no way we can eliminate, can do any better. We can't set this, for instance, to 0. So this is the best we can do. If we gauge fix, we can set A1 to be some time-dependent constant, and it's a periodic variable.
components of A? Do they not also need to be periodic?
They should also be periodic. We are going to work in a limit where there's zero. So that's another approximation we're going to make. But yes, we could. We could modify this argument to say something about A0 instead. We're going to set it to zero in a moment. That's all I wanted to say about the classical theory. And so now we're going to treat some aspects of the system quantum mechanically. In particular, we're going to treat the fermion field quantum mechanically, but we're still going to treat the gauge field as classical. And furthermore, we're going to treat it as external, some thing, and we're going to work in the adiabatic limit. So we're going to consider A1 to be external and slowly varying, classical. And we're going to make the further approximation that A0 is 0. So we're A0 in the limit we're working in. A0 would, in this limit, the adiabatic limit for A1, A0 would control the Coulomb interaction. So in two dimensions, the field strength only has one independent component, which is the electric field, F01 or F10. And so A0 in this limit where the time derivative of A1 is small, the spatial derivative of A0 would be what's controlling the electric field, which we're not going to include in our treatment. Again, this is for simplicity. All of these assumptions can be relaxed, and we will come to the same conclusions in a more complete treatment on Thursday. But this is the simplest way we can understand what's going on. So this. We're sending this to zero because we want to neglect the Coulomb interaction. This will be some sublinear effect. We could include it if we wanted to. Okay. So. If we want to treat the fermion quantum mechanically, what we need to do is to solve this equation in this limit. And if we work in the chiral basis, this equation just becomes d0 plus gamma 5 d1 minus a1. Psi equals 0. So I've basically just taken the equation. I would take the equation. Equation of motion. This just comes from varying with respect to psi dagger. And if you multiply by I and gamma 0, we'll get this. If you set A0 to 0. So you can make an ansatz for the stationary state solutions to this equation. and natural gas is that there looks something like e to the I and t times some spatial wave function. And since we're working on a circle, we expect our spatial wave functions to be e to the 2 pi I n x over L. And if we plug this ansatz into the Dirac equation, what we'll find is that e plus or minus is plus or minus 2 pi n over L minus plus a1. Again, what we're assuming is a spatial constant that's slowly varying in time. So that's what the spectrum should look like in this limit and in this particular gauge. So let's draw a diagram of what the spectrum looks like for a1 equals 0. So here's e. And here's the momentum. So there are two sectors to our theory. They're the right movers and the left movers. And the right movers have e equals p. Left movers have e equals minus p. And so this is a1 equals 0. And we just have our spectrum just consist of equally spaced states. So for a1 equals 0, both the left and right moving spectra are the same. So there'll be some state with 0 energy, state with energy minus 2 pi over L, and so on. And then there'll also be states with positive energy. And in the Dirac C picture, this is the ground state. In the Dirac C picture, all of the zero and negative energy states will be filled. So these are filled states. For the ground state, and the positive energy states will be positive energy states will be empty. These will be the holes in the Dirac C, and these will be the filled states in the Dirac C picture. So we are working. And the same for the left moving states, or the negative chirality states. OK, so that's what the spectrum, that's what the ground state looks like. And that's what the spectrum looks like. So we found the ground state here for a1 equals 0. And the next thing we want to do is to adiabatically increase A1 from 0 to 2 pi over L. So what happens if we do that? So first of all, if we make this choice, we've mapped the spectrum to itself. So we've just shifted all of the states up or down by one. So the left, the right moving states Right moving corresponds to the plus sign here, so that's the minus sign here. So the right moving states will all move down by one. So the occupation numbers won't change since we're doing an adiabatic shift in our gauge field. And so what the spectrum will look like is, well, all these states with negative energies will still be filled, but there'll be an extra hole. When A1 reaches 2 pi over L. And for the left moving states, the spectrum will shift in the opposite way due to the opposite sign here in this energy. So the states will all shift up by 1. And there will be a new filled state. When A1 is 2 pi over L. Okay, so why does that matter? Well, let's see what that observation tells us about the conservation of charge in our system. So we have one new, so in this Dirac-C picture, we should interpret the extra filled state as a new left-moving particle. And we have an extra empty state in the right-moving sector. So we have a new right-moving antiparticle. So there's an extra hole. So the left moving and right moving particles should have both have particle. Should have positive, or we can choose the sign of the charge. We can say they both have charge, say plus one. So we create an extra left moving particle and right moving antiparticle, so there's no change in our electric charge. But if we look at our axial charge, so the left moving particles and right moving particles should have opposite axial charges. So we can say that the left moving, with some conventions, we can choose the left moving particle to have axial charge minus one, and the right moving particle to have axial charge plus one. We see that by adiabatically varying the gauge field, we've changed the axial charge. So this is what was supposed to be conserved by Noether's theorem, both of these. And we see that there's a change in the axial charge. There's no change in Q. There's a change in the axial charge because we have one extra left-moving particle and one extra right-moving antiparticle. So the change in the axial charge is minus two. It's not zero. So this is our violation of Noether's theorem. The charge is not conserved by this process. Okay.
By this process, you mean the process of adiabatically varying A?
That's right. So this is supposed to be impossible by Spencer's theorem. This is a violation. And, well, we can figure out what the Noto's theorem tells us, that the current is conserved. So Noto's theorem's not valid in this case. And we've done most of the calculations. We need to figure out what the right-hand side of d mu, j5 mu should be. So it's not zero. Noto's theorem would tell us it's zero. We can, with just a little more work, figure out what that is. So first of all, we know delta Q5 is minus 2 in this case. We divide both sides by delta T. So the change in the axial current should be proportional to the change in A1. So we could imagine repeating this process. And instead of changing A1 from 0 to 2 pi over L, we could change it from 0 to 4 pi over L. And then we just have two holes in the right moving sector and two extra filled states in the left moving sector. So we'd have twice the change in the axial charge. So that tells us that delta Q5 should be proportional to delta A1. We can divide both sides of that by delta T. And our explicit computation tells us what the coefficient should be. So if delta A1 is 2 pi over L, delta Q5 should be minus 2. So this coefficient should be minus L over pi. And so the infinitesimal version of this, Q5 dot is minus L over pi A1 dot. OK. And we just want to write this in a form that looks like the conservation law from Noto's theorem. So we know that Q5 is defined to be the integral of J5, 0. That's the definition. We can also write L times A1 as an integral. It's just the integral epsilon 0 A mu dx. So we can write both sides of this equation in terms of something that's in terms of an integral. And if we want to put this together into an equation that looks like d mu j mu 5, something. So we've got one component of this, the derivative of j mu 5 over here. If we wanted to have something else over here, the natural term to have would be epsilon 1 mu a mu. But that's just 0 since we're working the limit that a 0 is 0. But that suggests that if we wanted to write the full equation like this, we'd just get our coefficient is 1 over pi epsilon mu nu f mu nu. This expects that this equation is just some component of a Lorentz invariant equation. This is consistent with everything we've seen so far. It turns out to be the correct equation. It's the natural guess based on our arguments right here. And so this is called the anomalous non-conservation equation. And what this says is that in the presence of a gauge field with non-vanishing field strength, the axial current, or the chiral current, is not conserved. So our treatment here was not the most general thing we can do, but it has the advantage of being very transparent. So we see explicitly how what's going on physically, why the gauge field is causing this charge not to be conserved. Okay, so that's our key result for today, and we'll generalize this to four dimensions and be somewhat more careful on Thursday without making so many seemingly restrictive assumptions. But we'll see that it doesn't actually matter. This is the general result. I just want to make a few comments about what we've seen today. So the first comment is that, well, the infinite energy levels and the Dirac-C interpretation played a pretty important role in our derivation. So we were able to map the spectrum onto itself by some adiabatic change. That was possible due to the fact that we had infinite energy levels. Something more subtle that is going on here is that that I made some brief references to last week, is that actually what's going on in the UV is playing an important role here. So throughout the discussion, I was focusing on what was going on in the IR near E equals zero. But actually, implicitly, the argument depended on a UV regulator that I didn't mention up to now, but was implicit in the argument. And to see that, let me just repeat the argument and explain the role of the UV regulator. So we had our Dirac-C picture. And I made the claim that the electric charge was conserved in this adiabatic process where the energy levels were shifted. Not something you could question. So in order to say that the charge is zero, we've got infinitely many field states here. So if they're changing, in order to make that statement precise, we should impose a regulator so that we can define the charge in a consistent way. So one way to do that is I can just impose, say, a hard cutoff at lambda and minus lambda. And well, I said the charge was conserved. And so the charge is conserved with this choice of regulator. So if the right moving spectrum shifts in one direction, say down, and the left moving spectrum shifts in the opposite direction, with this choice of regulator, every time a filled state leaves and goes below our cutoff, another one will appear above above the cutoff in the other part of the spectrum, so that the electric charge is always conserved with this choice of regulator. And that, so this choice reserves the vector symmetry. But this is not the only possible regulator I could choose. I could choose some other more complicated regulator that goes at some, maybe makes some angle, and so that, it doesn't have the property that whenever a state, during an adiabatic change, whenever a state leaves in one side of the spectrum, it appears in the other. And if I chose a regulator like that, this symmetry would be violated. And so that's, in general, a property of anomalies. So anomalies can be thought of as a conflict between different symmetries. And when the theory has an anomaly, it's generally, that means it's impossible to find a regulator that preserves all of the symmetry at once. But it doesn't mean that it's only possible to find regulators that violate one of the symmetries rather than the other. And we could make a choice that we wanted to preserve the axial symmetry instead of the vector symmetry. That would turn out to be a bad idea if we wanted to have a gauge theory in the end, because this vector symmetry is tied to the gauge symmetry, as we discussed at the beginning of class. But that is, it is a choice, and it's related to the UV aspects of the anomalies are a key part of the story. And we'll see that in a very different way on Thursday when we discuss anomalies from the functional integral perspective. So you think of anomalies are due to the conflict between symmetries and the impossibility of finding a regulator that preserves all of the symmetries. And yes, so we'll come back and study essentially the same anomaly, the chiral anomaly, but in four dimensions instead of two dimensions on Thursday from the functional integral perspective, and we'll see that any of the assumptions we made today are unnecessary. Any questions? Okay, I'll see you on Thursday.